So arriving into this space together, let's just take a short while to sit quietly. Just finding your body. In any way that you can. With a lot of love, care, tenderness as we come into relationship to our embodied experience. And just feeling the body, maybe you can feel the rhythm of the breath. And to the extent that you can, just receiving what is felt, what is experienced. With care, with patience, with tenderness. Appreciation. Just softening around the face and the shoulders, softening the belly, palms of the hands, down through the torso and legs, arms, soles of the feet. Perhaps on an exhalation. Noticing our awareness, just receiving sound, feeling, sensation, impressions. The awareness just is receptive. Moments of experience arising, being touched with knowing awareness, infused with listening, care. Tenderness. Discernment. Just as it is. Perhaps noticing how immediate and yet boundaryless awareness actually is, receiving what is, knowing what is in each moment, sound rising, is known and dissolves, still the listening remains. Phenomena arising, touching, awareness remains. Unblemished, undistorted, unharmed. Living, vibrant, deep source, presence, intelligence, just is, knowing. Maybe feeling around the heart center. What's the felt sense in the front of the torso of the body, where a lot of feeling tone is carried, a lot of impact happens. Just gently, kindly, sensitively, caringly receptive to what is felt. The heart down through the middle of the body into the belly. Feels too intense, one can just open into the space more of awareness, into the extremities, palms, soles of the feet. One can shuttle in and shuttle out in relationship to maintaining well-being, capacity. Not trying to figure anything out, but just allowing the intelligence of awareness, the healing power of awareness, just to rest in receptive relationship to what is felt. Being interested, your experience. So this theme this morning on engaged Dharma, I don't really feel to approach it from the place of what everyone needs to go and do, because I know the depth, or I don't know of course, but I feel and respect the depth of engagement already present in this room, and that none of us can avoid actually being deeply engaged in our lives and in the web of life that we're in, and deeply impacted by what's happening around us, particularly at these times. So really would like more to reflect on both the where we have gotten to from what's gone before, and how that helps us understand where we are, and the point of evolutionary, the pressure that is in some ways like a cauldron from within which this evolutionary task is unfolding, that is profoundly demanding of us at this time through the external crisis, which of course has its roots within the human mind. Everything comes back, as the Buddha rightly noted, to the mind itself. And its interplay with the worlds that we live within. There's an Arab-American poet and lawyer, Lawrence Joseph, who was asked recently in an interview to comment on the title of his book, a new poetry book, which is called Where Are We? And he says, well, if you mean by we, as Americans, where we are collectively is in a state of humanly created, destructive and violent political chaos. And forcefully being pushed back against that are acts of resistance grounded in the deepest human aspirations, justice and love. So I think we can all say that sounds about right. But, you know, this is an old story, so this is where we are now. For some of us, we're just waking up into that reality, and for many peoples, this is a millennia-long story, particularly peoples who have been in the marginal slipstream of the dominant narratives and power systems of a society in here in America. I think it's been very named, and we all know some of those systems, what they look like and what they are, and touch into those as I go on. But to recognize that over millennia, actually, over perhaps even from the emergence of the time of conscious human history, that we have an awareness of these two great forces of that which would dominate through destruction, through control, through oppression, through violence, and that which rises up to meet it and has the spark of birthing or trying to birth and maintain justice, love, equity, and to hold to an aspirational force. And these sort of play off each other in all sorts of storylines that are profoundly impactful and lived for us personally and generationally, and also around the world and through time and space. And these, systemic levels, that which there's, I think what's happening in the Dharma really, and as we know, the first generation of transmission of the Dharma transmission from Asia into the West, which was a sort of mix of coming through many different routes, and but primarily through more white middle-class culture, with the first white Western, but of course, as we know in America, there were long-time Asian presence of Buddhism that wasn't really acknowledged or honored or respected. In Chinese America, Japanese, Sri Lankan, Southeast Asian, I met a group in South Africa, where in around Durban is one of the largest displaced diaspora from India, the Indian population, that is Asian Indian, brought over, of course, by the British to to cut the sugar cane fields, the Indian Ocean, the coastline that goes up to Mozambique, right down into Durban, so sort of tropical coastline, lots of sugar plantations still to this day, primarily because the Zulu men refused to do the work, so women's work, and so Zulus gave the British a very hard time. And so there's, anyway, I'm sort of going off at a tangent, but, you know, this old story. But that I met a group there of Indian Buddhist practitioners. A lot of them are Hindu, Muslim, convert Christians. But that trace their lineage right back to Siddhartha Gautama. And so there is that still that stream. And of course, in India, we see also the so-called previously called untouchable Dalit communities that have been converting to Buddhism as a way out of the caste system. So there's a lot of presence of Buddhism here in America, but primarily as we know it, and here we are at Spirit Rock, come through white transmission. And I think that first transmission was very much about this quest for enlightenment, which emerged from the breakthrough of consciousness, primarily due to a lot to psychotropic openings, actually, that happened in the 60s, and then the weariness of Vietnam and the political uprisings, the civil rights and all of that that erupted in America around the 60s, and a breakthrough of consciousness that happened in that cauldron, that there was a real sort of focus on personal enlightenment and not really so much engagement. And so we sort of have this idea of engaged Dharma because there was a lack of it. And it wasn't necessarily the case, of course, in traditional Buddhist societies, where it's a bit of a misnomer term, or because there the monasteries provided, to some degree, a place of refuge, a place of education, a place of support, and were very, very interwoven with the village life, town life. And of course, that's very changed and so on. But this idea of engaged Buddhism, and I think it's very recent that we've now come to understand, primarily due, I think, in great part, to the enormity of the crisis that we find ourselves in, where we're facing the possibility we're definitely facing great extinction across the animal realms, but also the possibility of the collapse of human civilization due to extreme warming of the biosphere, the story that we all know about now, but wasn't perhaps so conscious for us until very recently, for many. So I think this has forced us to look not only at this presenting problem or symptoms, but to really look at the deeper systems that have brought about the causes that we now, the deep challenge that we face. It's almost like a sort of, on an evolutionary scale of human development, it really feels like the sort of ultimate test. This is the ultimate test that we've brought ourselves to as a consciousness, and how are we going to respond? And we can't really just put a fix, quick, you know, band-aid on it and quick fix. You know, I think there's a lot of... The other day I was at this reunion to do with my partner. He was a Rhodes Scholar and went to Oxford, and they have these reunions that we occasionally manage to get to. And there was one in San Francisco, and they had all these very high flying speakers, a lot from Silicon Valley that came up that were graduates from Oxford. And there was such a sort of leaning into the idea that rationality, academics, and even AI, technology, and so on would be the sort of fix that we need. A lot of the conversations were around that. I felt this deep, deep agitation about the real lack of understanding about the damage to the soul of humanity that has been incurred through these millennia, really, of systems. As Bell Hooks calls the systems, calls them out as the imperialist white supremacist. We could also talk about class, caste supremacist, capitalist. We could also maybe now call it more rogue capitalism or disaster capitalism, as Naomi Klein. You look at Puerto Rico, what's happening there, with a sort of result of the the devastation that these sort of venture capitalists move in, buying up land, creating golf courses, while the indigenous peoples, native peoples, are abandoned, completely and utterly abandoned. So this is actually disaster capitalism. Its disasters are actually good. You know, they're sought out, almost helped created for those that are extremely wealthy. And the patriarchy, which is perhaps the oldest system and gives birth to almost everything else, is at the heart of patriarchy. And it is, obviously, falls around gender, but it ultimately isn't about gender, because there is a great price to pay within the masculine, the evisceration of sensitivity and the feeling nature and the lack of permission around being able to own that and have that as part of one's masculine embodiment. But the, you know, really this whole system arrives from the idea of ownership and control and separation out from what was before in the work of, I've sort of brought this book so you can just look at it, of Anne Baring, who's an Anglo-American. She lives in Britain. She wrote this really wonderful book called The Dream of the Cosmos, which is about the evolution of consciousness as it goes through these huge spans of time. And she sort of names the lunar consciousness and the solar consciousness as part of our evolutionary journey. The last 4,000 years or so, really been more in this solar consciousness, the individuated ego being pulled really out of this deep sense of being within a web of life. That actually there was a time, and we have a memory of it, almost faintly, and definitely that wasn't lost in indigenous peoples, because for many indigenous peoples that's still very much their reality, was this really this deep experience of oneself, not as separated out from nature and from the forces of the seasons and from the relational field and from an ensouled world where everything was alive and had meaning and wasn't just inanimate dead matter, that everything, even rocks and mountains, were conscious and had, there was a relational meaning, and that the experience of spirituality wasn't so much through religious belief and hierarchy and through mediation of a sort of priestly caste or through obedience and dogma, which is what we've mostly experienced or in a deep reaction to, hence great interest in secular Buddhism and so on, but at still some expense to the soul. A reclamation of the sacred is sort of denied also in that, the rational movement of Buddhism. Sort of follows the European rational enlightenment thing, which continues that trajectory of divorce from this ensouled world. That instead, we, you know, there were ways of knowing that that we're trying to, in some ways, reclaim through that were more like a participatory consciousness, a direct interactive engagement, where what we knew to be true was more through intuition, maybe intuitive awareness, maybe meditative awareness. So the Buddha calls prajna, deep knowing, wisdom. In Buddhism, through dreams, visions, altered states, shamanic processes, often enacted through and in relationship to the plant kingdom. These were all deep ways that ancient peoples and still indigenous peoples have of being in understanding their relationship to nature, to the cosmos, as conduits of consciousness. And so therefore there was a great sense of belonging, which we've lost, which has been deliberately almost cut asunder. And probably for all of us, wherever we've come from, and whatever form that we're working through around and how we appear within these systems that bell hooks named, the wound that we all share is this great cut and loss of placement and belonging, from which I think there's a great compensatory movement. When you look at consumerism, this, you know, the word, the Latin word mater, literally comes from the root mother. It's sort of this loss of mother almost. You know, I don't want to sort of psycho activate everyone in the sense of, you know, parental mother, but the deep mother of the earth, the deep mother of nature, the deep nourisher, the deep connection with the stars and the cosmos, and the tremendous pain of the loss of that and this sort of consumption. You know, when I first, one of the very first times I came to America, and I was taken out to Staten Island with a beautiful, wonderful Statue of Liberty, and then to Ellis Island, and was looking at some of the original footage of the peoples, the displaced peoples, coming through that process from Europe, and how, you know, with a suitcase, and then they're really disheveled, really sort of like cut from their European roots, a lot fleeing all sorts of pogroms, famines, class oppression, displacement through colonialism, like in Ireland and so on. You know, getting a chalk mark on their back, if it was a cross, going, turning their coat around, trying again. And it was very moving for me to see and to realize that I think maybe a third of Americans, Western white Americans, came through that route, and Eastern Europeans, you know, maybe other places also that I can't name right now, but many peoples, displaced peoples, Armenia, Middle East, I'm sure many across the planet coming through Ellis Island. And it really, I just had this feeling, oh, no wonder there's this consumption, you know, because there's this feeling of needing to feed this great whole, this great loss of roots, you know. And then, of course, we know the tremendous devastation of the First Nation peoples and the genociding through the colonial project that we're looking at and addressing and naming. But the tremendous wounding, the rippling on through generational, I think we now understand a little bit more about generational trauma and even epigenetics, how trauma is carried actually in the genes and gets replicated and reenacted, how the ancestors are very much with us still in those ways, in our bones, in our blood, in our genetic makeup. And of course, we know too about the huge, tremendous, we don't know enough, you know, certainly in Europe, it's a story that we still are very blind to and in denial about, the deep engagement of the Euro-colonial project in enslavement of peoples from Africa. And that is a tremendous devastation still of over, what, 300-400 years of millions of people. There is an interesting map. You see it, you can just probably Google map displacement, Africans, slavery, those kinds of words. There's a map that you can, interactive map, that shows like little dots from the African continent going over to South America, Europe, you know, the Americas, the Caribbean islands, and so on. And it starts, you know, maybe late 1560, early 1600s or so, a few dots, and then it, like millions of dots, millions of. You can click on any one of those dots and get the ship, the country, the number of cargo, and the sheer number is overwhelming. And I just was reading an article the other day in Britain, which of course has been, sort of romanticizes itself as the country that sort of started to bring around the end of slavery. But what doesn't really get named is that actually the enormous compensation paid out wasn't to the slaves and their ancestors, that only in 1995, I think. No, actually, only 2015. I think very, very recently. Is it written here somewhere? There's a trouble with notes, is that you can never find it in the moment where you need to go. Anyway, you get my idea, that the taxpayers have been paying out the owners of the slaves. That actually the only way it really stopped was to pay out the people running the slave trade. That was the only way that they could legally stop in, I think it was about 1833 or so, when slavery was banned. But it wasn't. It was obviously there was a movement of an ethical, idealistic movement that this is not a good thing to do. But it was so deeply woven into the economics of Europe and then the colonial project that you could actually say the whole of capitalism was founded on the slave trade. And therefore there's huge implications for that in the terms of the wealth that particularly we as white descendants have been party to. And indentured labour of the working classes, of course, that went along with it, the press gangs pushing people into the ships and so on. But up until very, very recently, Britain taxpayers, of course, not the actual aristocracy or the ruling classes, of which many of our ruling classes, I think, probably about in Britain, about 75% of our current ruling class have come from the entitled upper class whose wealth was extracted from the slave trade. Cameron being a recent prime minister who brought in Brexit, a great point of division that's going on, was also descendant from that. So, these deep, deep roots into these present systems, and of course we know America, of what we're watching, a tremendous, this pyramid really of power, this, we go right back into the roots of these systems. It sort of enacts this pyramid of power where we see the loss of the sacred from the old ways. Even right up to medieval Europe, there was still a sense of science, still in a way being in accord with the laws of nature, until Galileo discovered the sun was the centre, not the earth, and then the Catholic Church had a bad reaction to that piece of knowledge. But the sacred really meant the old word, because we've lost, really what we've lost as our collective wound is not only the sense of belonging, but the sense of the sacred. There's nothing that's sacred in the capitalist worldview, in this ownership and domination. It's, there's lost the sacrum as the old English word means to consecrate. In Latin, it means to devote. It means to regard with reverence. It means to secure against violation and interference. It means to infuse with the divine and holy. So every piece of matter, everything, all of us are actually that. And yet how much, you look at the amounts of introjective self-aversion, which has all come from the systemic ripping away from our place, divine place in the cosmos. The karma of that is this tremendous deep lack of worth and guilt and shame that we're all still trying to free our consciousness from. This is a project to free human consciousness from these very old stories that hold us bound and in some ways disable us from really enacting and engaging deeply at this time, because we get held still in fear, in diminished narratives about ourselves, all of which in meditation we're attempting to deconstruct. So this deep rise of the individuated consciousness, which, as Ayn Baring said, out of the web of life, is an evolutionary process, as it is when we grow up and leave our parents or the mother's womb, we have to individuate psychologically, and it's quite painful and it's fraught and it can go wrong, and it has in a way as a collective human individuated consciousness, what she calls the solar consciousness, arising out of the lunar consciousness of the old ways that went on for so long in pre-remembered history. Has really brought us into this great these systems which we're in recovery from, and even diagnosing and revealing, and for some of us a newer project, as I said, for many deeply immersed in that. I mean, go to at Standing Rock, you say this is a peoples that have been battling this for 500 years. or any colonized country been battling this. This sort of pyramid of power, that it's not a belonging, it's not an equitable, it's not a reverence for all beings, there's a pyramid of power that gets that we're still living within, which is a myth, but it has power. You know, that there is this sort of abstracted God. God isn't within the material, isn't within matter, isn't within the earth. The sacred is not there anymore. It's divorced and it's up somewhere in heaven. As an authority, as a judging, often, if you're looking at Judeo-Christian metaphor, as an abstract, over God, over man, and man over woman and nature and animals. Yeah, so, and whiteness, it's not just white, the whiteness, you know, like in Africa, I notice when I go into the pharmacies, there's the amount of lightening creams. it's really, really how this metaphor of whiteness has gone through into peoples of colours and communities. I think we heard from Joanna, her wonderful and very brave. And I mean, this talk that Joanna gave yesterday, I just was sitting there thinking, you know, when I grew up in the Dharma, no one talked about sex. I mean, partly because I was in Britain a lot, but we don't really talk about we're all very repressed over there. But you know, to bring this very important subject, however it landed for you, just enormous courage of that, enormous courage of all the teachers and all of the group here that has been enacted and trying to bring these things into light. But this sort of whitening, the whiteness over colour, internalised it great, profoundly, and now, of course, we see it enacted in such horrific ways in the current political climate. And then people over animals, and I just there's this way. I mean, in the 1500s, Francis Bacon, who was one of this co-emergent movements towards the rational European science, along with the great profound dominance of the Catholic Church, which furthered the ripping apart of our collective consciousness. One of his statements is, "Nature, bound in service, hounded in her wanderings, put on a rack, tortured for her secrets." And I think this is the metaphor we're still in, and you know, applying also to the animal kingdom, the plant kingdom, trees, breathing kingdom, sentient kingdom. It's that these, if you look at the animal industry now, which I really just want to take a minute to speak to, because it does get left out of our contemplation when we look at, you know, speciesism. This is another system that we live within that has a huge amount of unconsciousness around it. Animals are, I mean, all beings, plants, trees, they're all living, sentient, conscious, even mountains and rocks. They're just going at a slower vibration. You know, because we can't see with, it's like a dog can hear a higher tone. As humans, we actually have a sort of narrow band of what we perceive in our range of consciousness. But it doesn't mean to say that other, what we call matter, isn't vibrating and alive at a whole different level of conscious time span, and even subtle unseen beings. It's not just what we see and perceive. There's a whole lot of other realms going on and other vibrational realities going on. But this refusal to see animals, I mean, really what's happened in this systemic rise of consciousness, in the way that it's been so individuated, and then with this rise of, I mean, this is a very simplistic diagnostic, and forgive me, I know many of you know so much more profoundly about these and studied academically, but this tendency to see everything as a machine and us as a machine through the mechanization and industrialization that we've all gone through, which also ripped us apart from land and community, that there's this tremendous way now that we also project that onto the animal kingdom through these agricultural factory farms and farming practices. And I think it really, it's really important for us to really look at that, and to the tremendous work of people exposing that, for them to see that, to see what actually happens For animals, you know, we were talking about sexuality, how we interfere with their sexual rhythms, with their productive rhythms, with their family groupings, how we've completely dominated and tortured and continue to extract what we want from that kingdom, from that animal kingdom, without any regard or respect or love or softness. And it is profoundly, profoundly tragic. Billions of animals every day across this planet. You know, Master Xunhua, one of the great Chinese masters that we learned from, said that if you really want to understand the roots of violence and wars, go to a slaughterhouse at dawn and really see what it involves. And so this too is something that we really need to awaken. It's part of our awakening journey. We're looking at all of these systems, everything that we're implicated in. It's not to judge, it's not to look at someone else, because everyone has their own relationship to figure out, and we're all implicated. I think, as Temple said the other day, you're just driving, you know, we're slaughtering. And my brother, who does actually live like a traveller, he sort of lives very much on the land. He completely refuses the whole technological industrial world. And he has a very, very deep knowledge of how to survive on land and live in nature. And you go for a walk with him. This is in England. And he can, in Ireland too, where part of my family is still. And he can, like, oh, you know, there's a smell, there's the fox and this and that. And he knows all the stories. And he was just, when I go, it's like, he's just so heartbroken to see so much disappearance, even of the bug life. He said, you know, when we were kids growing up, there was a light outside the door and there would be like hundreds of moths and insects, and there's not a one, you know, and just all the loss of the rivers and the fish and all of this. I mean, I think what we're really talking about when we open up, and I think, you know, I understand how we can get so defended in denial. I don't want to judge that, you know, because we're really looking at a tremendous heartbreak. You know, we can't go into this journey of awakening and reclamation without touching into the tremendous heartbreak that what we have done and where it has brought us to, and how deeply painful that is. I mean, unfortunately, you know, from a Dharma eye, it is on some level all empty and anatta and conditioning. But I don't really want to rush to that place as a sort of quick solution, because I do think we have to feel the heartbreak as part of our evolutionary reclamation of healing. And, you know, and to recognize how deep our denial is around what's happening. Like, I lived through the AIDS pandemic. I was at the heart of one of the centers of it in deep KwaZulu-Natal, 15 years or so that went on. Still going on, tremendous devastation. And the government, and then it was the ANC government, at that time, went into 10 years of denial, and that we don't have this. And I understand, I can actually understand how it came to that place. I mean, this new liberation, the excitement of it, and the racial implications in contracting HIV, and all of the tremendous wounding around that, and devastation, and the shame, and how that unfolded, that it was just easier to say this doesn't exist. And we had ministers dying of AIDS saying there's no AIDS. And, you know, we have that now. We're going through an iteration of that here about climate change. And the attempt, like, if we can just remove the words, if we can completely gut the EPA, if we can actually remove all evidence that we don't have racism, we don't have a catastrophic situation that we're in the midst of. It's all happening. If we don't really look at, you know, actually take ourselves to look at a slaughterhouse, it's all happening behind closed doors. You know, so part of when we talk about engagement, I think part of our engagement is to go everywhere that we don't want to go. You know, and to look at it and to let it impact us and let our hearts break. And I think in some ways what's interesting about what's happening politically in America, which is horrific, of course, you know, is both the pinnacle of this egoic consciousness, this individuated Anne Ryan, Thatcherite, Reagan, neoliberalism, religious fanaticism, controlling supremacist, classist movement of egoic consciousness, and its supreme arrival at its great power. You know, and look at it. It's, you know, it's narcissistic, it's despotic, it's venal, it's craving, it's unethical, it's cold, sadistic, vengeful, abusive. It's insane, corrupted, toxic. I've got such a litany of adjectives that I produce on Facebook from my spleen, like the finger on the spleen of, you know, someone said, you know, that this, you know, it's like the finger on the spleen of America. You know, and yet this is the child man enraged, you know, this is the egoic consciousness of that can't control it all, that wants it all. Like the Koch brothers, there was this, I mentioned going to that documentary, the Best Democracy Money Can Buy, Oakland the other day, and you know, Koch brother, if you know, I want my piece of the pie, I want it all, which is all of it. That's that consciousness. I want it all. I want it all. I want to dominate it all and control it. And if I can't have it, I'm going to kill it. It's cold. It's the extremity of the divorce from the deep belonging to each other. And ironically, there's something positive in this horror show that we're living through. And for many, I want to say that many, for many of us in the white culture, we're waking up to it. For many in the people of colors culture, and they've been it forever. But there's something about the horror, complete and utter horror show, is that we can't go into denial, actually. Well, we can. You can always, and people do, and they're massively doing it in the most extremely insane ways, you know. But as Ajahn Chah would say, in regards to personal practice, when you can't go up, you can't go down, you can't move to either side, that's when the practice really begins. You know, that's when, and this is, you know, so that's why ultimately, although it, it's a very high risk, I have to say on behalf of the deeper intelligence of reality, because there is a deeper intelligence of reality, we're not in control as much as we'd like to think that, but we're controlling a lot, and we're changing the destiny of the planet, there's no doubt about that. But, you know, that on behalf of that, it's like a really high risk strategy. It's like, you know, let's take us all to the precipice and you've got a choice. And it's very, very clear, and it's on every level of our being now. So we don't really have to talk about what are we going to do, because we're so deeply engaged. This is a very conscious group. You know, we know that we're standing at the precipice of, you know, of climate devastation, extinction. 90%, I think even 99% of global wealth, with the 1%. Without hiding it anymore, you know. So, and here we are. You know, it's a lovely sunny day in Marin. You know, and there's a piece of wisdom that, you know, Eckhart Tolle says that, you know, ultimately, we're not a person, we're not people per se, we are, I don't want to deny that, we are, deeply so, but ultimately we're a focal point where the universe is becoming conscious of itself. We're at a deep level where consciousness becoming conscious of itself. And this is an extraordinary journey. Consciousness, in the Sharangama Sutra, which is a Mahayana Sutra, talks about two roots of consciousness. It's called beginningless ignorance, beginningless birth and death, where the mind climbs on causes and conditions and becomes shaped by that. That's called samsara. That's mostly what we know. And then the second root is primal, which is the primal essence of consciousness. It's not really Theravada language, but I'm not going to try and apologize for that. Primal essence of consciousness, conscious awareness. You know, the Buddha called it the Amata Dharma. We want to translate it, the deathless Dharma. this is us too. And this is not just static. As we know in the wisdom territory, Prajna Paramita, Prajna, wisdom is dynamic. You know, it's intelligence. It's emerging from this primal conscious awareness. It's engaged. It's responsive. Highly attuned. Is all, you know, as said, all beings are resident in this awareness, in our awareness. There's no separation in reality. It's a construction of the mano-vijnana, the mind that goes out and names. This is called the vijnana, the consciousness that, of the mind that separates, differentiates, an important aspect of the mind, which we use a lot. This is you, this is a tree, this is that. You know, I'm using that consciousness now to articulate. But the trouble is we think that's the only reality. We think if I say tree that we really know what a tree is because we have the name for it. You know, but in all things resident in our awareness, that's a different level of conscious awareness. So in some ways, in our journey of awakening, I'm much better than coming to this talk and realizing I need to wrap up quite soon. I just say that following the path in this talk of the four truths, the diagnostic, and the remedy. There's always a remedy, and then the path of action. You know, the remedy really, and the way it applies and intersects with what we're doing here, is to awaken into how we operate within separative consciousness. At the most subtle level, which the Buddha named as the papancha, the proliferations of the mind, how that goes out and through languaging and through naming, there's this constant tendency to create the other. And that's useful because we want to diagnose and look at things, but it's not the deepest consciousness that where we're going to reclaim what we need to reclaim. So to practice in a way, as Kuan Yin says in her enlightenment, or his enlightenment manifests, Kuan Yin manifests both as masculine, feminine, and trans, in how and represents this deep consciousness, deep conscious awareness. The moment of Kuan Yin's enlightenment, again in the Shurangama Sutra, talks about that. Through the listening, the depth of listening, that was her meditation, the contemplation of sound, returning to the hearing. This is the basis of Zen practice, this sutta, by the way, this sutra, of turning the mind back into its own nature, basically. I came to realize the unification with the Buddha's mind, the mind of all the Buddhas, and the unification with all beings. So you have the whole span of conscious awareness, that at this depth, there is the complete and utter resonance with it, with all beings. All beings are resonant within this awareness. And the pure awareness of the knowing of Buddha mind is the knowing. Buddhi means to know deeply. To know not just through differentiated consciousness because I can think about you, but to know through really sensing and receiving what is. So that when I stand with another, I can know you through my cognitive mind, but I can also know you as part of the one reality. The shadow and light play, the play of light and shadow that has gone on for millennia and it becomes the crucible from which evolutionary birth and movement happens as it is now, this birthing of our new world that is actually also happening, the midwifing, and we are midwifing in so many ways a new consciousness. We don't even quite know we've got the appearance of it through the deconstructing of these systems. It's very clear that these systems that we've been living under, it's either death to us and the planet as we know it, or the systems change. That's it. That's the choice. And we're all engaged in that very deeply. You know, and it feels ginormous. I mean, it feels completely, there's no way we're going to win out on this. That's what it feels like at this particular moment. You know, and it's a bit like Frodo and Sam when they're going to Mordor. You know, under the eye of Sauron, you know, like Sauron had the all. I mean, that's what we've got at the White House, the eye of Sauron. You know, this is the tower, this is Mordor. Yeah, it totally metaphor works, totally, you know, ripping up the trees, and the orcs are out there in full, you know, they're not even hiding anymore. They're out there, they're blooded kind of orcness, ravaging the land and the peoples. You know, King Théoden, sort of under the power of Wormtongue, the decrepit old king, shadow king, in his venality. Blah. So, you know, the Hobbit, you know, here's the Hobbit. You know, what have they got going for them? Not a lot. You know, they love to go to the pub and have a dance and, you know, tell poetry and have a good time, hang out in the Shire, you know, and here they are up against Sauron, you know, slogging away across this landscape, you know. So, and then at a certain point, Frodo just says, I can't do it anymore. You know, I just can't take this ring and throw it back in the fire. I just can't do it. And Sam goes, you know, but you kind of, you know, like, you got to. And Frodo says, well, why? You know, that's a good question. Why the heck should we? You know, like, why don't we just give up? You know, there's definitely a part of me I can see. I just want to roll over. Like, yeah, just this is way too much. And Sam goes, you know, it's just like those stories of old. You know, that when people always, there's always been the stories of old and great challenges, and that then people won over, and you know, we won over. And then Frodo says something like, you know, but why do we do that? And then in the end, Sam's sort of clincher argument, he said, well, because there's always goodness and it's worth fighting for. There's always beauty, there's always love, there's always aspiration, there's always justice, there's always truth, there's always reality. That, you know, that there, and it's worth aligning with. It's worth, you know, it's never over. It's never over. You and darkness that I come from, I love you more than all the fires that fence in the world. For fire makes a circle of light for everyone. No one outside learns of you. But the darkness pulls everything in, the shapes and fires, animals and myself. How easily it gathers them in, powers and people. And it's possible a great energy is moving near me. I have faith in nights. Zuruka. We're in the sort of a night... sort of soul, night soul, and yet that which is the light is pulling in all the shadows so we can see them, you know, this light. And we know that, and not to know, you know, part of this journey is, yes, we know and we do stuff. You know, I do think we should do stuff. You know, there has been a lot of lassitude in the Buddhist community. You know, it's all sort of transcendent and impermanent, and let it just all dissolve. I don't think we see the Buddha doing that. Actually, he did respond, he did engage very profoundly in the systems and overturn quite a few very significant systems. Where do we do it from? That's the issue. Where do we do it from? Do we do it from the place that we keep separating out? And yes, it doesn't mean to say we don't discern history and separation. But, you know, we're not each other's enemy. You know, there is a sort of enemy. There's some very serious, you know, you really want to look at what we're fighting against. You know, this sort of oligarchic, one percenter, you know, corporate, rogue corporate control of the electoral processes, of the narrative, of the resources. I mean, there is definitely, you know, Mordor out there. You know. But where we come from, I love this piece. I'm going to finish here because I recognize that this is a lot. But there's a teaching from Nisargadatta Maharaj, wonderful realized being, where he says that the knower comes and go with the known and is transient. So that we see in Vipassana. The knower and the known come and go. We see the transient. But that which knows, it does not know, which is free from memory and anticipation, is timeless, is undying, is truth, is reality, is our deepest refuge, and it is that is our ally. So it's not that we have to know everything, Because when we strip away our known worlds, when we really arrive in our deepest heart, the heart of listening, then that which knows, it doesn't really know in the way that we know things objectively, but it then has access to, the, as the Ajahn Chah would call, the living Dharma, the deep intelligence that always is, always has been, that's speaking through us, that responds, and that will lead us, that will guide us, where we need to show up, what we need to do, what is our heartbreak, what calls us to action. And then when we feel that, the task is in right action to respond. So it's 10:05 on a Wednesday morning here in Marin. Beautiful day. Let's take a silent break until 10:20, 15 minutes, and then we'll regather. Thank you so much.